Hello and welcome to the Jesuit Border Podcast. This podcast explores the humanitarian response along the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. My name is Brian Strasburger.
And I'm Joe Noya. We're with Del Camino Jesuit Border Ministries, located in the Diocese of Brownsville, Texas.
This podcast aims to humanize the migrant experience by sharing stories from our ministry and highlighting some of the amazing work that people are doing along the border and throughout the country.
The Jesuit Border Podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post. Let's begin.
Vamos!
In this episode, we're going to talk about fasting.
We'll be interviewing Eleanor Acer, who is Senior Director of Refugee Protection at Human Rights First, an organization that works in the U.S. and abroad to promote respect for human rights and the rule of law. Stay tuned for that. But first, we want to explore the Lenten theme of fasting. Now, usually when we talk about fasting, we talk about depriving ourselves of something as a way to cultivate our freedom, like giving up sweets during Lent or not eating meat on Fridays. In our work with migrants, I'm often struck by how often a fast is actually imposed on them. That is to say, as opposed to it being something freely chosen, it's something that a migrant is denied or deprived of against their will or their own desires. That becomes part of their migrant journey. For example, I think about Carmen. Carmen is an unaccompanied minor staying in a center here in the Brownsville area. So unaccompanied minors are children under the age of 18 who come to the U.S. without an immediate parent. They might come with siblings, they might come with other family members, or they might even travel alone with a group of other migrants. When they come to the United States, U.S. authorities house them in local centers around the country as they're assigned caseworkers who verify their destination in the United States, basically to ensure that they aren't the victims of human trafficking. So it's an important security protocol. On average, a minor will stay in one of the centers for about 2 to 3 weeks, but you know, if their case is more complicated, it can take months. And we've seen that, where kids are staying in these centers for an extremely long amount of time, which can be very disheartening, of course. But on Wednesdays, we have kids from these local centers. They come to our parish in Brownsville for a time of prayer and reflection, usually led by the Dominican Sisters of the Presentation at our parish. After the reflection, we sit down and we sit at the tables with the kids and like to have conversations with them.
Oh, yeah. All sorts of things.
And so I was so struck by my conversation with Carmen this one time, which was not unlike the conversations I have with many of the unaccompanied minors. Now, it started off light, talking about where she was from, Guatemala, and where she was headed in the U.S., Tennessee. Then I asked her about food from a home country. That's one of your go-tos, isn't it, Joe?
Go-to icebreaker. People have strong opinions about food, indeed. I like to kind of make it where, kind of say, hey, whose food's better, the Guatemalan food or the Honduran food?
And just watch
let it happen. Oh, yeah.
No, it's good because people love to talk about food, right? I mean, who doesn't like to talk about food, especially the food from your home country? And sometimes you don't realize how unique or different it is until you're in a different country, right? And so all of a sudden, these kids are in these centers in the United States and they're being fed basically U.S. cafeteria food, which frankly, none of us would really want to have on a regular basis. And that's kind of what they're getting fed 3 times a day. So that, I think, is kind of an obvious form of fasting right there. Again, not in this kind of voluntary freedom sense, but the sense of them noticing a lack, noticing that they're not having the food that they're used to and that's typical to their home country. And it's something that they really miss. You know, for most of these kids, this is the furthest they've ever been away from home. It's the longest they've been away from family. So when you're in one of these centers, all of a sudden, these are some of the things that really stick out to you. But besides the typical food that they missed, another form of fasting that sticks out for me with kids like Carmen and the conversation I had with her is the fact that they don't have a cell phone. All right. Now, this isn't their choice either, but the kids in the centers can't have cell phones. They can't make call. They can make calls every home every week or so, a couple times a week, to be able to catch up with their family and speak to them, that kind of thing. But they don't have their own private, personal cell phone. Now, let's just be clear: teenagers from Latin America are just like teenagers from the U.S. They are glued to their phones, right? But, you know, now all of a sudden, the unaccompanied minors in the centers don't have access to that cell phone. And it's tough for them to be without it. But what I see and what I saw certainly in this conversation with Carmen was the fruit that can come from this sort of fasting, the way it can provoke a lot of reflection that maybe a teenager wouldn't give time or space to if they had access to their phone all the time. And so talking with Carmen, she was reflecting so much on her past, and she was reacting very emotionally as she thought about her relationship with her mom, especially, and, you know, the things that she hadn't done well or done run right, or kind of the last thing she said to her before she left. And now they've talked since then, but just some of those past memories were kind of coming back and replaying. She has a very complicated relationship with her father. He's not in the home, separated from the family. And so just her feeling about how she wants to be in touch with him or how she wants to relate to him and struggling with that. And she's got some siblings back in Guatemala still who are with her mom. And so reflecting on them and those relationships. Basically, she was just, as she was getting emotional and reacting to all this, she was just thinking about mistakes she had made in the way that she had handled in very important relationships in her lives and ways she wanted to go about those differently. And I think those were provoked by the distance and by the isolation, but also because she was free of the distractions that otherwise might have filled her life and her time. And so it might have been an involuntary fasting, but it still was one that I think provoked a lot of self-reflection and personal growth, which is what we hope is born out of fasting. Now, this doesn't mean I think parents should take their teenager's phone away for Lent, but I have been impressed at the depth of reflection from youth like Carmen, who I've had the privilege to talk to. Now, of course, this isn't the only aspect we could reflect on in terms of fasting, right, Joe?
No, yeah. So you have that involuntary kind of fasting that you're talking about, but then there's also that voluntary kind of. One important aspect of fasting is the for aspect. You know, what or for whom are we fasting? And kind of as you kind of talked about, like in our tradition, we willingly go without so that we can be attentive to God and to the needs of others. And I'm reminded of Gerline, a Haitian woman who I got to meet for the first time in Christmas Eve in Matamoros. And I was in the parking lot and she ran over to talk to me and she was asking me to help her. So I said, well, okay, so what do you need? You know, and
yeah, well, you ran into her in the parking lot. I love that because, you know, this shelter that we go to, you rarely make it into it.
That's true. You're not wrong. It's
an appropriate place for you to encounter her. It's the Pumarejo shelter, which is a migrant shelter that houses up to 1,000 migrants in Matamoros that we visit regularly. And, you know, we park her car and then Flavio and I are inside. We're setting up for mass. And it's always like, where is Joe? I can't see him. Inevitably, Joe is still in the parking lot. So, yeah, please continue. No surprise from my perspective. That you met
Gerline
in the parking lot.
Yeah. A fun little aside. When I finally got into the shelter, mass had already started.
Also, not surprising.
No. So I asked her what she needed, and she just introduced me to the needs of the other migrants around her, saying, help me get this woman into the shelter. Help me with this family who's been kidnapped, etc. And then when I saw her a few days later, I learned that she wasn't even staying in the shelter. And so here is this woman who was so concerned about the needs of others that she willingly sacrificed her own needs. And of course, she's now in the shelter. We got her in. And she's continued to be just a wonderful example of faithful service. She helps at her masses as a lector and sometimes as a cantor. And she leads a rosary group. She accompanies women to the hospital for moral support and translation help, being she speaks Creole and Spanish.
Yeah, I've been really impressed. I mean, Gerline is just an amazing, amazing person and just so participatory in helping out. I mean, I even love, like, when we have a choir singing music for our masses there, she's, like, right there clapping and singing along. And whenever she can, she grabs a free mic and she wants to, like, join her yeah. voice to everyone's. It's great. Like, she is just so involved and engaged in the liturgy.
Yeah, and people – both Haitians and non-Haitians feel very comfortable talking with her. She's one of those rare people who are able to kind of bridge that divide, which is just super impressive. And she's definitely not without needs of her own. She's certainly deprived in a number of ways, but she always has that space in her heart for God and for others.
Yeah, that's that spirit of fasting. We talk about fasting as that giving up something, but it's also about what we give up something for. And so how Gerline represents fasting in that spirit of self-sacrifice that can really be part of it, that sense of giving of oneself for the needs of others. So there are a lot of ways that we can think about this theme of fasting that's so fundamental to Lent, and that can include giving things up, like meat on Fridays or giving up something for the duration of Lent. But it's helpful to think about those who go without every single day, those who are deprived of things that are basic, those who sacrifice themselves for others. You know, another thing that migrants are often deprived of is their basic human rights. To hear more about that, stay tuned for our interview coming up next with Eleanor Acer from Human Rights First. We are excited to welcome to this week's episode of the Jesuit Border Podcast, Eleanor Acer. She's the Senior Director of Refugee Protection at Human Rights First, an organization that works in the U.S. and abroad to promote respect for human rights and the rule of law. Thanks for joining us, Eleanor.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be with you today.
Great. Maybe an initial question that we could use just to get off the get started here. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Human Rights First and how it was that you got involved with the organization?
Sure. So Human Rights First is a U.S.-based human rights organization that works on a range of issues. We work to uphold human rights around the world and here at home in the United States, too. One of the oldest programs that has been very central to our work since our founding in like 1978 has been our work to help make sure that refugees seeking protection in the United States can actually get asylum. And we do that through our advocacy. We conduct extensive research to help advance refugee law here in the US. And we also work with volunteer lawyers at law firms to represent individual refugees who are seeking asylum in the United States. And you know, over the years, we've helped thousands of people actually get the protection of asylum and make sure that their families can stay here safely in this country. I actually got involved because I was a lawyer at a law firm. I was doing securities litigation.
Oh, wow. That's a little different.
And got recruited into taking on a pro bono case and represented a couple of asylum seekers and decided that this was such important work that I really wanted to switch what I was doing with my career. So that's how I got hooked and involved in the issues.
Wow, terrific. How long have you been at Human Rights First now?
Many years. I actually joined the organization back in 1996. So okay. I've seen a lot and been around for quite a while in this field.
That's kind of what I was thinking, you know, talking about asylum law and the way that has in some ways been the same thing that it's been since it was kind of written in the post-World War II era. And yet in other ways, we've seen such an evolution, certainly in terms of the claims people are making for asylum and the way it's been adjudicated. I wonder if you could share a little bit from your, you know, multiple years of experience, how you've seen kind of asylum law and its interpretation evolve a little bit in the United States and maybe what your greatest concerns about it might be.
So, you know, asylum law in the United States is based on international refugee law. It's based on a treaty that the United States entered into in the wake of World War II. Right? There's a UN refugee treaty and the U.S. signed on to one of its protocols, and it basically makes clear that people should not be returned to a place where they would face persecution on account of their race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. And really, you know, since the earliest days, the refugee law internationally and here in the United States has been intended to protect people who are victims not only of state persecution, right, but also of non-state persecutors in situations where a country fails or refuses to protect people. And you can see why, you know, the very same people who might be at risk of a government because of their nationality or their religion or their race might be at risk in a country that allows them purposefully, you know, or recklessly to be persecuted as well. So that actually has been really quite, you know, consistent over many, many years. I think, you know, one of the shifts we've seen, recent years here in the Americas is more and more people fleeing violence at the hands of non-state persecutors, right? But actually, more recently, as you look at the situation, for example, in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and the increased numbers that have been fleeing to the United States, you know, even more recently, it's in many ways a situation where the countries people are fleeing are countries where there is significant levels of state persecution.
So when you're talking about non-state actors, we're talking about situations like a drug cartel, for example, in Central America has a lot of influence in that country and creates an environment of violence. And it's that environment of violence that might not be the state itself. It might not be an official wearing a uniform persecuting someone, but these quote unquote non-state actors that are members of this cartel, leaders of the cartel, whatever, armed and threatening, are creating situations of fear, which is causing a lot of people from a country like Honduras or Guatemala or Salvador or some parts of Mexico to flee their countries. And so I think you're making a very important point that I just want to highlight in terms of refugee law, because it seems like the kind of conventional understanding of a refugee is someone fleeing the state-sponsored violence, kind of this, like you said, this post-World War II era, this Nazi Germany is extinguishing a people and we need to provide protections. But that might not be the exact image of every country today, although it can relate more to some of the countries you've mentioned, like Venezuela and Nicaragua, for example.
Yeah, and some Americans actually, you know, will think of gang, he'll hear a phrase like a gang or a cartel, and they'll think of, you know, sort of in the American situation, oh, okay, there's some criminal group here, right? But it's a very different situation where you've got, you know, when you have a situation in countries where literally these groups, you know, are armed groups that control large swaths of territory, where they act in effect in many ways, you know, as the authorities, or the authorities are in fact often complicit in what's actually being done. Now, that doesn't mean everyone, you know, fleeing violence in those countries is going to be eligible for asylum. There's actually so many hurdles you have to pass in order to prove your eligibility for asylum. So, you know, it's not simply a matter of fleeing from a country where your life is at risk. It's actually quite, you know, difficult to fit into the refugee definition.
Some of the things that you're mentioning, from what I'm hearing, kind of involve misconceptions that can be out there, like misconceptions of what are the roles of cartels? What is asylum law in this country? What does it refer to? Who does it protect? Are there any misconceptions that you feel have a most urgent need to be addressed? They're the ones that say kind of, okay, this is the most prevalent misconception, and if we just knock this one out, we will be a step better. Like, is there a misconception like that comes to mind?
One of the misconceptions that we, you know, constantly encounter is this perception that somehow policies that are cruel and that inflict harm will prevent people from fleeing to the U.S. to seek refuge. And in fact, you know, it's actually not the case, right? In fact, people fleeing from a burning building, if you lock the door, they still are going to do everything they can to actually try to leave. They'll jump out of buildings. They'll be forced into more dangerous routes. And that's what we see. You know, these cruel policies that cut off access to asylum, that prevent people from actually seeking refuge. At the end of the day, they're counterproductive from a migration management perspective, as well as from a human rights perspective.
I think sometimes we just have such a misconception of what it means to quote unquote control. And for some reason, we think the harsher, the better, when really I love that image. It's like the burning house burning down and locking the door. What good does that do? That only subjects someone to more harm and creates and encourages them to use more dangerous ways to get out of the burning building. As a couple of Jesuits, one of the things that I think about is, as we're in this Lenten season, an important part of our year that has different components to it. And one of the main parts of it is fasting. We talk about the importance of fasting, which is kind of a self-chosen deprivation. To say no to certain things is a way to kind of grow in freedom. And I think that's a really good and healthy and helpful practice. But one of the things that I think about about fasting in light of the migrant situation, I think about the lack of freedom and so many of the deprivations that are part of their life and their journey. And so I wonder, especially in light of the work of Human Rights First, what are some of the real deprivations that you see in your work, especially as it relates to refugee and asylum seekers, in terms of the things that they are denied against their will, without them fasting from them, but being denied it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say starting from their home countries, they're denied the protection of their state, maybe persecuted directly by their state. And then, you know, there's this common misperception that somehow people should be staying in other countries, right? That they really could stay in other places. And in fact, the vast majority of the world's refugees are in other countries. 6.5 million of the 7.7 million people who fled Venezuela are staying in other countries. But what we're seeing increasingly in some of these countries that are hosting large numbers is deprivations of rights there, increased xenophobia, efforts to try to deprive people of sort of more lasting status and the kind of, you know, security and access to jobs that they need to rebuild their lives. And then obviously at the border, people who are seeking asylum and other migrants face a litany of human rights abuses. They face abuses at the hands of Mexican officers who sometimes, you know, are complicit with the activities of cartels, sometimes assist in arranging kidnappings. They face barriers to accessing asylum. And then when they come into the U.S., when they're taken into CBP custody, the conditions under which they're held are notorious, right? I mean, they're held in these places that are known as freezers, essentially, often. So many are thrown into immigration detention when they come into the United States, and you know, treated as though they are being prosecuted for crimes, put into prison uniforms. It's horrific.
I remember maybe a couple of months ago or something like that, reading a recent report that your organization put out and about a lot of the stuff that's going on in the border of the appointments. And one of the things that was such a dominant feature and characteristic of this report was the focus on individual stories, where it's not just we're seeing – not just statistics. If we're seeing X number of these sorts of incidents, it's kind of like a mother of three from Ecuador said this. This is her story, things like that. So these deeply – personal, in some ways, gut-wrenching stories. So you have such an experience with these personal stories. And to kind of go back to the theme of fasting, have you encountered a story that has stuck with you of someone who has willfully gone without for the sake of a loved one or for the sake of someone else? So have you encountered a profound story of self-sacrifice?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, so many of the parents that we speak to, right, are sacrificing themselves for their children, day in and day out. I remember one mom we spoke to in a shelter where they were, you know, she and her daughter were living in hiding, and you know, she recounted to us how they had been kidnapped, held for ransom, and witnessed, you know, unspeakable cruelty and torture. And they themselves, luckily, as far as they told us, right, had not themselves suffered the way they saw many other people suffer. But you know, this mom, all she could think of was her daughter and trying to protect her child. The words of her daughter will always, stay in my mind. She said, "Mommy, I don't want to die." And the mom did, you know, everything she could to try to protect her child. And miraculously, they ended up actually escaping, which is rare that you actually hear of people actually being sort of, you know, allowed to escape without paying substantial funds of money. They miraculously did escape. But there's just so many, you know, so many stories of people, and you hear a lot about, if you watch on the TV news, often talks about military age men, right, who are coming to the border as well. And I just keep thinking of, okay, I've met many of these men, and yes, they're coming on their own because their family is in hiding somewhere and they're hoping to get asylum and then bring their spouse and child here. Or, you know, one young man we met, you know, his elderly mother was already in the United States. They were all seeking asylum and had to flee, separately. So, yeah, I think it's at the heart of it, you know, this is all about people. And I think once you've met people and you really understand the kinds of harms they're fleeing or the kinds of reasons they're coming here to the United States to rebuild their lives, it dramatically changes your perspective.
So, hopefully with maybe your expertise, you can shed some light on this, because this is an interesting phenomenon that I think people would be surprised of. Sometimes on this southern border, you encounter people who are just not from the Americas. There's some people who, for example, very recently I was talking with a couple from Kyrgyzstan who had crossed the southern border. And this is not – this does not fit the stereotype of what the narrative presents. Why would something like that be the case? Why would someone fly, say from Kyrgyzstan, fly to another country to cross in through the southern border?
So there's always been people from other countries who've come to seek asylum along the southern border, but the number has increased, and there's a bunch of reasons for that. I mean, it used to be that a person could get onto a plane and travel to the United States and seek asylum, right? But it's become more and more difficult because the United States and even other countries, you know, have enacted visa restrictions that and made it tougher for people to actually get a visa to fly into the United States. So oftentimes the only way people can get to the United States is to fly to another country and then try to travel to the U.S. To the U.S. southern border. You know, there's often nowhere safe for people to go. I mean, if you've got asylum seekers, let's say, you know, many African asylum seekers are finding it harder and harder to actually get to Europe to seek asylum. And then, of course, there are smuggling networks as well. Some people may have family in the United States. And if you look at, you know, where does it make sense, you know, for you to go and seek asylum? Where does it make sense for you to go and try to rebuild your life? That's probably somewhere where you have family, friends, a network of people that can help, you know, help you get on your feet, help you integrate into a new country.
Yeah, that's right. It is an interesting dynamic, and it is so global. And part of it is, you know, the United States has a very well represented global population, and so I think it's important not to overlook the kind of family and personal connections that can often be a main driver for immigration, because it is for so many of us, right? Oftentimes, you know, parents who move to where their children have settled because now they're having their grandkids and they want to live nearby, right? I mean, those kind of personal dynamics are a part of what encourage migration in general, at least where you migrate. Obviously, the compelling reasons can differ depending on, you know, it's one thing to move to want to be close to family. It's another thing to move to where family is because it's not safe where you are. So those are different dynamics at play. But they're the kinds of things that shape some of the migrant flows that happen, I think, around the world. And that's just something to be attentive to. You know, you've had this long career now at Human Rights First, Eleanor. And I think in that work, you're an inspiration to many. I wonder, in your own life, who is someone that's been a mentor or model for you, or someone that you've gone to seeking advice or that's helped inspire you in your own work and mission?
You know, I've been lucky in that the leaders of our organization, you know, we do a range of human rights work, have always been inspiring people. But I actually find that, you know, it's often the refugees that we work with, the people we work with, really, that are inspiration to, you know, to me. I mean, I look at all they've had to overcome. I look at, you know, how difficult they've had it in the face of so many challenges. So, you know, it's a good wake up call if I'm, you know, at all feeling a little bit bad for us that we have to struggle with, you know, an insane Congress or an administration that's, you know, doing things we think are wrong. At the end of the day, it's really important to remember that people's lives are on the line and that these people are themselves truly inspiring.
Do you have a story from your early days when you kind of made the transition, when you're doing that pro bono legal work, of someone in particular whose case you worked on that just kind of stuck with you and that you stayed in touch with over the years?
You know, I was very lucky at the time. You know, I was much younger than I am now. And I worked with two young people on my asylum cases. One was a young woman from Ethiopia, whose family was a victims of political persecution. I stayed in touch with her. And the other was a young man who was involved in the Tiananmen Square protests. In touch with him too as well. Yeah. And, you know, he actually came to our wedding, and my husband and I got married many years ago. So, you know, I think it's a privilege to do this work because you get to meet so many people from different countries, and so many people who, bravely stood up for what they believe, who've been targeted because of who they are or what they believe. It helps renew, my hope that this country, should be reminded of the fact that many people do believe this country, was in many ways and has been a beacon for human rights. We've fallen clearly here and there and egregiously so in many ways. But, it's just important to remember how at the end of the day, living up to, our stated principles really matters.
I think sometimes in this work, definitely the case for myself, and I think you can speak for Brian, this as well. We can't help but kind of look forward into what will come, that kind of thing. There's kind of like hopefulness. And for those of us who are religious, we often end up thinking about things like heaven and images of heaven. For example, like heaven as haven, where people do come and get that safety and that rest, And I was wondering if there is a particular image of heaven or way of thinking about heaven that especially speaks to you.
So I grew up in a Catholic household grew up with the values of welcoming the stranger and do unto others, what is the golden rule, as you would have done unto yourself. And those, those really are the values that have guided me all my life. I think when the first thing that sprung to my mind when you mentioned heaven was how difficult it is. What is it for a camel to get through the eye of a needle? What is the saying?
That's right. Yep, exactly. That's how difficult it will be for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven.
That's it. Yes. And I think of that when I think of, I look sometimes at the behavior of so many of some of our leaders, right? And some politicians in this country who, who purport to care about their faith. And to care about people of faith in this country, and yet, push policies and say things that, we're going to make it pretty hard to get through that eye of the needle someday.
Yeah, we pray for conversion of hearts and minds. I think we all need it in different ways, and some need it more publicly maybe than others, but it's a good call to virtue, right? That we might actually represent the values that we profess, and I don't think we always do that. Eleanor, if as we kind of wrap up this interview, if there's one thing you could tell to our listeners, what would you want to say to them?
For people who care about asylum, who want the United States to be a country that doesn't turn people back to places where they suffer persecution, it's more important than ever for Americans to tell their representatives in the Senate and in the House of Representatives to save asylum, and that you care about asylum, and that it's important that this country have an effective asylum system and not turn people away to harm. I just would urge people to really, take the time to do that. Pick up the phone, send an email, even better, pick up the phone and let your members know.
Terrific. I think that's a great kind of sending forth. We'll include in the show notes of this episode a link to where you can find your representative and a way to contact them so that you can call them and tell them to save and protect asylum because it matters to you. We're kicking off an election year, 2024. The border and immigration and asylum are going to be in the news and in the public conversation a lot. And I've got kind of a controversial suggestion I'm going to make right now. You know, I'm a little bit disillusioned by the candidates for presidency. So I don't know if now I could make the nomination for you, Eleanor, to be a candidate for the presidency of the United States, to stand up for human rights so that the United States can truly be a beacon of human rights around the world. It might be a controversial choice, but I'm going to put your name for it. I don't know. Is there some piece of paper I can fill out to do that?
You got to put in a – there's a suggestion box. You know, at the okay. Just look for the DC suggestion box and just –
I'll write in your name as well. That write-in space on the ballot.
That's true. We got the write-in space. Maybe this is the launching of the write-in campaign.
Either one of you would do a much better job than me.
Well, we'd have you on speed dial. I can tell you that if it ever happened. But no, really, Eleanor, we want to thank you for the great work you do, the advocacy you do in D.C. for immigrants, the great reports that you put together in defense of refugees and asylum seekers. The visits that you've made here, you're, of course, always welcome back. And we thank you especially today for joining us for this interview.
My pleasure. And thank you so much for all that you do. You are my inspiration. So thank you.
Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. We're grateful to Eleanor Acer for joining us.
Remember to subscribe to this podcast to hear more about the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. You can visit our website at delcamino.org.
If you're curious about Jesuit life or know someone who is, visit beajesuit.org to learn more about a religious vocation to the Society of Jesus.
This podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post.
We'll see you next time on the Jesuit Border Podcast.
Que Dios os bendiga.